Welcome to episode 13 of While I Breathe, the official podcast of the ACLU of South Carolina. I'm your host, Jace Woodrum.
I'm your other host, Paul Bowers.
It's been a minute, Paul. Yeah. Been a minute since we've been recording. I'm glad to be back, though. Glad to be back in the saddle. Maybe we should just call this season two.
I've been meaning to say, welcome to season two, everybody. That's what we're calling it.
Yeah, we've missed these conversations, and we're trying to be better, get back at it, and start rolling out consistent episodes each month. You know, we really got a little bit off track because of that darn legislative session.
Yeah, they keep us busy. We are finally in a season where we're not having to keep an eye on subcommittee meetings every week and keep pressure on the state house. So yeah, breathing a little easier, I guess. And it seemed like a good time to start podcasting again.
I agree. And, you know, for folks who have been listening to the pod for a long time, you know that we, at the beginning of the legislative session, introduced you to one of the biggest threats that we were up against during the session, which was sending public dollars to private schools through school vouchers. That did pass. It's the second or the third time the legislature has passed it. It has been struck down as unconstitutional in the past. We will see what happens this year. But that is one bit of bad news from the legislative session. I will say, though, there were a lot of other bad ideas that our legislators proposed that did not become law yet. It's always important to say yet, but you know, there were a number of things that folks turned out. They testified, they protested, they showed up in force, and a number of things did not become law this year. A number of things that would have harmed trans South Carolinians, a number of things that would have harmed our efforts at diversity, equity, and inclusion in the state. And it's a pretty long list. So I am thrilled the legislative session is behind us. And so appreciative of folks who volunteered and got involved from January to May to make sure that our legislators didn't bring undue harm to our communities.
Yeah, I think one highlight for me was a day when there was a hearing about a more extreme abortion ban than the one we have. And there was a hearing about a ban on diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. And people just packed the legislative building. I mean, it was a line out the door wrapping around the building, people waiting to get inside and speak. And I was there for the DEI hearing, and it went for 4.5 hours, just straight nonstop, people speaking for like 2 or 3 minutes at a time. And every single person opposed this bill. Everybody said, please don't spend your time attacking diversity, equity, and inclusion. And I've just never seen anything like that. And, you know, all credit goes to our advocacy team and all the different groups that they're in community with. It was a huge team effort, getting the word out, bringing people out. I'll plug this again at the end of the episode. But if you want to stay in the loop, if you want to find opportunities to come speak out or show up for civil liberties in South Carolina, ACLUSC.org/volunteer is our volunteer form. And if you go through that, you can check off the areas that you're interested in, and our team will let you know when something's happening, when there's a chance to show up. So again, that's ACLUSC.org/volunteer.
I'm glad you reminded me of that day, Paul. That was such a powerful day with the abortion ban hearing and the DEI hearing. I am so incredibly inspired by folks who volunteer and show up and force the legislature to open overflow rooms and to let us in and to give us our 3 minutes. Oh, what a great day. What a great day. So what are we here to talk about today, Paul? Our episode one, season two, episode one, aka episode 13.
Yeah, for our season premiere, this is something we've been planning for a while. It's a panel discussion with transgender South Carolinians from a lot of different backgrounds, different parts of the state, different experiences. But it is an idea that you and I have been talking about for a while. And I should mention up top, it is an idea that we are shamelessly stealing from our friend Chase Glenn, who was longtime director of the Alliance for Full Acceptance. He did an event like this in person, like 6 years ago now in North Charleston, where it was just an open Q&A session, like come meet some of your transgender neighbors and ask questions honestly, and they'll answer honestly. And it was so well received that I thought we should try something like that and maybe do it in podcast form. So here we are. We're finally doing it. Thank you again, Chase Glenn, for letting us rip off your beautiful idea.
Well, thanks, Chase. Thanks to AFA, who helped us pull this off. Excited to get into this conversation. Let's do it. I'll be honest, I am so excited for this discussion today. You know, Paul and I have been talking for a while about getting some super cool trans folks together for a conversation like this, and I'm so grateful to all of you for being willing to join us. This is also, in my mind, a really timely conversation because June is Pride Month, of course, and because any day now we could get a ruling from the Supreme Court on the Scrimeti case, and that's the case out of Tennessee where the court will decide if banning gender-affirming care for trans kids is constitutional. In big moments of trans visibility, like the one we'll experience when the Supreme Court rules, it's so important to have the stories of real people out there. Our stories are powerful, and they will help combat some of the misinformation that's out there. That's out there now, and that will be out there when the court rules. So I really do appreciate your participation on the panel. I'm also grateful to the brave folks who sent in questions that they wanted us to cover. You know, it takes courage to come onto a podcast to tell your story, but it also takes courage to be vulnerable enough to admit you have something to learn. So thanks to those folks who realized that they wanted to learn something. Because as Maya Angelou said, when we know better, we do better. So I'm going to jump right into this conversation with our amazing panelists here, and I'm going to start with a bit of an introduction question. Can each of you take 2 minutes to introduce yourselves, tell us your names and your pronouns, and share with us a little bit about your gender journey? You know, one of our questioners asked, how do people know they are trans? So I'm especially interested in knowing that as a part of your introduction. For this question, Gwen, why don't you start us off?
Sure. So my name is Gwen. Pronouns are she, her. I realized I was trans when I was 36. FaceApp actually got me. I did the gender swap filter like all my friends were doing, and it was like the very first time I had ever seen a photo that I felt like looked like me. Every other photo of myself, I always kind of like ducked and dodged out of the way because I didn't really want to be seen. And when I saw that photo, even though I knew it wasn't a realistic portrayal of myself, it made me realize that, oh, yeah, that's what I'm supposed to look like. And kind of started my process, which was long and tedious, but here we are. And overall, it's been really great. Like, except for some of the politics things, my life has improved drastically.
My name is Sterling Mazanin. Pronouns are he, him. My story is kind of convoluted, I guess, because I knew when I was younger, but there was a lot of stigma and shame around wanting to be anything other than, you know, quote unquote, what you were born as, especially in my family. So I didn't actually, you know, have the vocabulary or the knowledge behind what those feelings were until I was an adult. And then I didn't actually formally come out until I was about 28, 29. But yeah, I mean, I always kind of knew, you know, since childhood.
My name is Ebony Sims, and my pronouns are she, her. And Her Majesty, because in my own perfect world, no one sits above me. So I think that me being almost 60 years old, the word trans has only been around for about the past maybe 20 years at the most. So there wasn't a term for what I thought I was or knew that I was. But my journey began just dressing up, and I've been arrested for that in the past before the movements took place. So therefore, I knew that I was trans when there was a word called trans and a definition behind it.
Thanks, everyone. One of the things that kind of came to my mind as I was listening is this idea of coming out, which, you know, for generations has been so important to lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans people, queer people. You know, this idea of being honest about who you are with the people you love. I remember for me coming out, I guess I was about 29, and I wrote letters to my parents and my sister. And then I did a super weird thing. I came out in a video. I was working in the LGBTQ movement, and my boss and I made videos each week about something we were working on. And I was like, I guess I better make a video about this. I'm working on me. And so I came out in kind of a weird way, I feel like. But I'd love to know, how did you come out and how did folks respond when you did? And let's start with Ebony this time.
Great. So I think that my coming out, if you will, came through my art of drag. I started doing drag, and I knew that through pageantry, the more convincing you were, the more money you could make. And I believe I started doing alterations before it was legalized, so to speak. And from there, I had no choice but to come out. And I think that the coming out place for me was running away. I had to run away in order to come out, because I knew that being in a space with my family and friends, there wouldn't be acceptance with me asking for that permission. So I had to go away to get gain my own permission and my own acceptance. And after coming back, I had already accepted myself. So I didn't really need that approval anymore. So my coming out was kind of forced on everybody else, but it was time well spent preparing for myself.
Thanks for that. Gwen, how about you?
So I came out like 3-4 years ago. When I had just gotten married like 3 months before I realized I was trans, so that was my first kind of hump, was talking to my wife. And honestly, I assumed we were getting divorced. I just, you know, straight girl, kind of assumed she was going to be out. But that was a hard conversation, because wasn't quite sure what was going on yet. I just knew that there was something weird with my gender. So we worked through that together. It took us about 6 months to get to kind of a super stable place again. As for the rest of my life, I just kind of rolled with it. I called my brother up and let him know, and I called my mom, and that was a whole like 20-second conversation, but our relationship's always been a little strained. And then like I just picked a random day to come out at work and just went with it. I figured, what's the worst that can happen?
How did people respond, Gwen? Did it go better than you thought?
Well, I knew it was going to happen. So I came out about a year after I realized I was not cisgender. And so I had told most of my coworkers that I was going to be like transitioning, but I wasn't really sure when and how and like all that stuff. I ended up coming out about 3 months before I started hormones, because I was just sick of it and didn't feel like dealing with it anymore. But overall, it went pretty smoothly. All my coworkers were pretty okay. Like, I worked for an affirming company, so, like, policy was that they would have to be okay. And now I work at a job that's mostly queer people.
Awesome. Thank you. Sterling, how did you come out? What was that experience like for you?
Yeah, so my coming out kind of happened in phases. First, I had to come out to myself, and that was during the pandemic, right? I was single, living alone, just me and my dog. And, you know, there's nothing more exhausting than lying to yourself all the time. So when I finally stopped, that was just a really good light bulb moment for me. And it happened that I was already looking to transition jobs just because of things that were going on in the company I was at. So when I took my new job, it was across the country, and I used that moment to be a, I guess you could say, a new me in a completely new place. So when I came to the Charleston area, I actually just kind of came out when I was here with the new friends and stuff that I had made. I really ingratiated myself into the queer community here. It's a smaller city, so that wasn't, you know, too hard for me to do. And then after I was really secure with that and felt really confident in myself, that's when I started coming out to my family and my friends. And for them, my friends, I knew they'd be super supportive. You know, I have a range of friends with varying backgrounds. Many of them are queer themselves, so I didn't think that that was going to be necessarily a challenge for them to accept, but it's still a daunting thing to have to come out. You know, my best friend's been best friends with me since we were in kindergarten. So, you know, even if they're a really accepting person, it's still something you build up in your head that you have to disclose to them, almost as if, you know, you feel like you're kind of lying to them for a period of time, even though that's not really the case. But they were really accepting. And I ended up actually coming out to my extended family first because they're very liberal and, you know, they're very open and vocal about who they support and the, you know, the kind of causes that they back. And I used that to really secure myself before I came out to my parents, who I kind of hinted at, you know, with my introduction, are a bit more conservative. And I actually had to come out to them over video chat because it was still the pandemic. So I had my sister on the call with me, and I was really, really fortunate that they were pretty accepting. They had no clue what it meant when I came out. You could tell that they were very confused. They didn't understand anything about the, you know, vernacular I was using or any of the culture or anything that this kind of entailed. But you know, I also made sure I didn't come out until I was financially and socially independent, because if I had both the knowledge and the words when I was younger and the courage, it would not have gone as well. And then for work, I also work at a very, you know, affirming company that has very good zero tolerance policies in place. So I actually came out, transitioned after I had already started there, because when I moved, my legal name and gender markers and all of that, they weren't changed, and I wasn't medically transitioning yet at that time. So that all started after I started at the company. So I ended up coming out partway through my first year with them after my formal name change, and when you couldn't hide some of the, you know, the changes from testosterone and the HRT, but they were all very, very supportive, and they've continued to be very supportive and, you know, vocal to me about the stuff that they want to make sure that I feel really confident in my current workplace. So I am really fortunate in that kind of situation.
Thanks, everyone. I mean, I think hearing all your stories and the differences just remind me of how coming out is so distinct and different for each of us. And there's not one way to come out. There's not one way to be trans. For folks who are listening, there are a few words that our esteemed panelists have used that I thought I might need to take a quick moment to define. So the word cisgender is a word describing people whose gender identity, that internal sense of oneself as gender, aligns with their body. So not transgender equals cisgender. And then you may have heard Sterling say HRT, that is hormone replacement therapy. That is something that many, but not all transgender people do. I think I caught most of the trans lingo we have because we're in a safe space with all of us here. But thanks for sharing that. I appreciate it. And so happy to hear the amount of support that many of us have been able to find. You know, of course, we're not universally supported, but I think there's this sort of misunderstanding that transgender people are often left alone through transition. And many of our stories show that people have loved us through it. They've had questions, and questions are fair, and yet they've been able to love and support us. And that is such an important piece of so many of our stories. So some of the folks who sent in questions want to understand more about transition, and I get the confusion because transition looks different for everyone. I mean, there really isn't one way to transition, and many of us, not all of us, talk about two types of transitions. Like, one type is socially transitioning, which often refers to changing your name or pronouns, maybe changing your hair or your clothing. And then the other type is physically or medically transitioning, which involves healthcare, such as HRT, hormone replacement therapy. It may involve surgery. So, you know, personally, I did both. I changed my name. I asked people to use he pronouns instead of she. I updated my identity documents, like my driver's license and passport. And I was fortunate that I was able to access medical care to change my body. I often tell people I have a 9-year-old, I'm a dad, and when my 9-year-old was little, they often described my being transgender as, and this is their words, you had a girl body, but a boy brain, heart, and soul. And I've always thought that was such a lovely way to put it. So for me, it felt right to change my body so that it aligned with my brain, heart, and soul. And for me, it was absolutely medically necessary to access hormones and surgery. I really don't know where I'd be without it. And I know that not everyone feels that way. So all of that to say, how have you thought about socially transitioning and medically transitioning? And how did you know what was right for you? And for this one, we will start with Sterling.
Yeah, so I started with my social transition first. Like I said, it was what was capable at the time. It was the middle of the pandemic, so I knew that I was done lying about who I was. So for me, the social transition, it really took place with making myself kind of. I always dressed how I wanted to, so the clothing didn't really have to change much, but, you know, the pronouns, my hair, the name that I go by for sure, very, very different. And with every step that I took, it just felt more and more right. You don't really know how uncomfortable you are until you get the chance to feel comfortable. And that was how I knew that it was the right choice for me to do that. And same with the medical. I knew that the social wasn't going to be the precipice of my transition for me personally. I always knew that medical was going to be on the table, but I had to wait until I had, you know, coverage with my new job. And I've always struggled, you know, even pre-social transition with not just dysphoria, but also body dysmorphia. I've had, you know, many issues with the way that my body looks. And again, the only thing I can describe, I've gone through a couple of different types of surgeries, and I've done, you know, HRT. And every step of the way, it's just felt more like myself. When I look in the mirror, I'm so happy. You know, it's kind of like what Gwen had mentioned earlier about the photo of never wanting to really see themselves before. I used to hate getting my photo taken. I used to hate seeing my reflection. You know, I didn't really think anything of myself. And now those are some of the things that I enjoy the most, because I really think that I look like how I'm supposed to. So
that's really beautiful. Thank you. Gwen, how about you?
Sure. So like I did socially transition first. I was fully out to everyone before I started hormones. Socially transitioning was big for me. It really did make me start to feel a lot more comfortable with myself. Hormone therapy, though, was like a whole new world for me. It felt like my brain worked finally. Like I was on a pile of mental health meds and really struggling to keep my stuff together. I am off of all of them, although I should probably be back on my ADD meds, but that's neither here nor there. But overall, like my mental health improved so much with my hormone therapy that like, even if I didn't get any of the other side effects, that would have been well worth it for me. But the other effects have also been great. And I've been really enjoying the fact that my body feels like mine. It was always so hard for me. I mean, and Sterling touched on this, but like it always felt like my body didn't quite belong to me. It always felt like I was kind of like a passenger in my own car, like someone else was driving and I just had to follow along. And once I started like hormones and really like got like was accepted by the people around me and things, it really made me feel like my life was my own finally. And that medical intervention really changed my entire like worldview and my life. And it was huge for me.
Mm, thank you. I love to hear the differences in our stories and then the similarities. I feel so similarly, Gwen, as the way that I felt when I began to feel myself change, see myself change, and the positive mental health impacts. Ebony, what about you? How have you thought about and made decisions around socially transitioning and physically transitioning?
For me, socially, I think that everyone around me already knew me as Ebony long before I went through and had the name change processes done. Medically, I started this transition a long time ago, and this was long before hormones were actually available, and if they were, they were not available in my community. And we did things to alter our bodies and everything to make us almost become the person on the outside that we knew that we were on the inside. I think that's why it's my biggest fear with this political climate, that the new people, new trans sisters and brothers, will have to revert to doing that. That's why I'm so much of an advocate for making sure that we are able to hold on to the things that we have now. For me, medically, again, I did some things that I wish I had not done, but that was the only way out then. Now I've went back and I've corrected some of the mistakes by going to have the things that I've done in the past corrected and doing them properly. And now I feel like a completely different Ebony. Although I transitioned 25, 30 years ago, I feel like my transition is still new, because I'm feeling whole, because I know that now everything that I've done medically is okay.
Now, Ebony, your words really remind me of how far we've come. It's easy to think in this political moment that it's the worst that it's ever been for trans folks. And I don't want to downplay how harmful it is right now and how many people are being hurt by the loss of healthcare or many of the other anti-trans attacks. And yet you remind us of a time, your story reminds us of a time when, you know, before all this progress had been made and the harm that was happening then too. And it harkens to the stories of so many social justice movements of progress and backlash and progress and backlash. And you know, I'm really hit by how you know, how we're standing on your shoulders, Ebony, not to put you on the spot here, but just how much you, as an older trans person, how much you had to face and overcome. Okay. Now, many of us just talked about how important gender-affirming healthcare is, and at the ACLU of South Carolina, that's one of the things we talk a lot about, gender-affirming healthcare. And so here's another great question from a fabulous question asker. How difficult or easy is it to transition? This is like a four-part question they sort of threw at us. Is gender-affirming care affordable, or does it depend, right? So how easy or difficult is it? Is it affordable? Does it depend? Ebony, you've talked a lot about what it was like, I think you said 25 years ago. So maybe we'll have you start, and we'll go then to Sterling and then to Gwen, kind of answering this question.
I think that... For me, I think trans, I have to look at the word trans, and the textbook definition of trans is to change. So that I believe that the difficulty comes from how hard is it for you to change what you've been taught. I think most of the time we were raised as, hey, this car is for boys and this doll is for girls. And although we felt that we really wanted the opposite, we were programmed that we should take the one that was the choice that was made for us. So I think that the difficulty comes into play in how well you can adjust to making that change. And I think that when it comes down to healthcare, I think it's easier than it was in the past, but I think that it's still difficult to access that healthcare. I work in a CBO, and I help so many trans people try to get to the endocrinologist or try to get their name change processes and all of the things that we require. And I think that they put roadblocks in the way. It's accessible only if you have a method of getting around the barriers that they put in front of us.
Sterling, what about you? How difficult or easy is it to transition, and is gender affirming care affordable?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I'm gonna tackle the affordability part first, and talking specifically about a medical transition. If you live in a larger city or metropolitan area, the access for sure is gonna be much easier, especially if it's a liberal area with protections built in place in, say, like the city legislation or the state constitutions. Same with the healthcare, right? I believe right now that the marketplace healthcare still requires coverage to an extent. I know that that's kind of on the chopping block. But some private health insurance carriers through work, like my own, also can carry it, but it's not necessarily required or guaranteed. So the affordability is really depending on these factors. Because without that, let's say you're in a rural area and your work doesn't cover it, the medical transition options are really, really quite pricey. So it can seem really inaccessible and really quite hard to do those kind of factors if you don't have those things set up. I do know that there are a lot of really great programs set up, and as odd as it's going to sound, I know a lot of people actually work really well through GoFundMes as well to try to help any sort of, the affordable aspect of their transitions. Difficulty and easy for a social standpoint, I think it depends on the support that you have, right? You don't choose the family that you're born into, but you certainly choose the family that you stick with. So my chosen family here is made up fully of friends. I'm lucky enough that my born into family is more or less supportive as well, but they're not nearby. They're all thousands of miles away in different states. So it was easier for me in that sense to transition because I surrounded myself with really good people. And I'm a huge advocate of mental health. I made sure that I was set up with a good therapist that I could work through all of that stuff through. But that's how I needed it to be set up for myself. So I think that's really dependent on what is your support system. The same with any kind of change in life. I think if you don't have the right support in place, or if that support is conditional, that's going to make the journey more difficult, but it's never impossible to say that. So,
all right, Gwen, how about you?
So I'm just going to touch on my personal experiences and not like the broader picture, because I feel like that's already been covered pretty well. So when I realized I was trans, the first hand it was I got a psychologist and worked with her pretty thoroughly, because I didn't actually entirely know what was going on. And I knew that I was going to end up having a lot of like traumas and things like that come to the surface that I wanted to be able to deal with in a timely manner. I did that for about a year, which is generally kind of within the overall guidelines. And then I went and found an endocrinologist with MUSC. Now, I was there with them for a couple of years. My insurance was covering it, so that was great. The blood work is pretty expensive and you need it regularly. And I know that cost barrier can be a lot for some people, and that's a relatively small one. Surgeries and such aren't really even on my option list. I don't think that they're affordable, nor do I really know that I want to have them done. But MUSC, as we're probably all well aware, no longer offers transition healthcare. And because they stopped, I haven't been able to find a new provider. So I'm kind of riding out what's left of my hormones. And I don't know what I'm doing next because I haven't been able to find anyone that has the capacity to take me, which has been difficult to say the least. I'm very, very stressed about this. But it's almost been so stressful. It's been paralyzing to a certain amount, which hasn't helped me look. So the accessibility and such is really going to be dependent on who you are, where you are, what resources you have access to. And that's really not a good way to set up a healthcare system, but that is the one that we currently have.
Gwen, thank you so much for sharing that. My heart goes out to you because I heard you say how incredibly, you know, life-changing, maybe even life-saving hormone therapy has been for you, and can't imagine how you must feel with the loss of that or the impending loss of it due to MUSC's decision to stop providing gender-related care. You know, I will say this is one of the things that a lot of people don't realize, because politicians want us to think that the laws they are passing are all about protecting kids. And our law here in South Carolina has impacted many adults. These are adults who received care at MUSC and at Roper St. Francis. It also has impacted folks who are on Medicaid, folks who are state employees. And so the number of adults who are trans who have lost this access to care, it's quite substantial and incredibly harmful. So my heart goes out to you, Gwen, and I'm sorry you're facing that. It's really quite infuriating when you think about it and you hear people's stories like this. I'm going to change gears a little bit and throw a question at y'all that may come across as a little bit offensive, but we did tell our questioners that we were a panel of people who were willing to hear questions that folks were afraid to ask. And so I'm going to warn you here and then tell you that, you know, hopefully some folks will want to take this question on. So here's the question. At what point do you get to call yourself blank, a man, a woman, etc.? Now, while you all are thinking about this, I think behind this question is a pretty binary and rigid view of gender, right, that we're all taught growing up. So no shade at the questioner. This is how we're taught about gender. I remember I was doing a radio interview once. I'd come out maybe 2 years before. It was a call-in show on Sirius Radio. And a caller asked me, you know, what surgeries have you had? And after what surgery did I consider myself a man? And gosh, it was a really jarring moment, in part because I've always embraced the idea that I am a trans man. I don't typically think of myself as a man, but as a type of man. That's not to say that that's how all trans men feel. That's just me. So I considered myself, you know, a trans man from the day I came out, when I hadn't taken a single hormone dose or had a single surgery. And for me, my transition is really a journey, and I feel more like myself today than yesterday, than the day before. And that isn't because I've done X or Y, but because every day is another day I'm living authentically. But that is just me. So what do y'all make of this question? At what point do you get to call yourself a man or a woman? We will start this one with Sterling.
That's a really tricky question, for sure. So I think, you know, if you're talking about it in the serious sense, which I'm hoping that the questioner was, it's really to each their own. You are able to call yourself whatever you identify as the moment you identify as it. You don't necessarily have to take any sort of social or medical steps to get to call yourself anything, right? As long as you identify that way, and like I said, with a serious manner. There are people, like you said, Jace, that aren't on the binary. And so that is actually how they feel, right? There are gender fluid individuals. There are non-binary individuals. So what you identify as, I don't think you have to do anything to classify that. For myself in particular, I do identify as either a man or as a trans man. I know some of our peers, sometimes they get a little caught in their heads with using or not using trans in front of, you know, an identifier for themselves. I don't have a problem with it. But I also, especially, you know, at work and stuff like that, I don't make it my entire identity because I try to make my work mostly about the work that I do. So for me, it really helps to kind of take that part out of it. But I've got no shame and no qualms with being called either thing. Did I go by that right out the gate? I was not as brave as Jace. No, I did not. I did for the people that didn't know me beforehand because they had nothing else to compare it to. But for my family, especially, I really tried to like incept them into the coming to terms with seeing me as a man. So I really went into a gender fluid, mostly, you know, a trans man. And then over time I was like, it's just a man. It's not actually gender fluid. And that was mostly just so that they could really come to terms with it. Especially my parents, they really needed to kind of have a lead in moment. I couldn't just drop them right off the cliff. It's just not how they function personally, but.
I mean, I do agree with Sterling that I think that's very deeply personal and it depends on the person and how they view it. But I actually had a question very similar to this. The very first time I did any public education at a church, I had someone ask me when my transition was complete, like when was I a woman? And at that time I hadn't even started hormones. And I was like, I'm a woman now. Like my brain is a woman. And it's not my fault that my body didn't get that memo. Like, I'm just trying to get my body to catch up at this point. Like, but I know who I am, and I am a woman, period. And like, yes, it could be potentially a weaponized perspective to have, but like, what perspective can't be? I think that it's important to be honest, and if you aren't, you shouldn't pretend to be something you're not. But like, I also think that like, there's something different about trans people that makes them trans, and there's nothing wrong with that. And I think that the idea of you having to qualify yourself by doing these certain things in this certain way is just harmful to the community, because a lot of those resources aren't accessible and available for everyone.
For me, I'll have to revert back to earlier when I said that trans means change. And before I had breasts, or before I had the body or any of these things, I saw this long before anyone else saw it. So I think at the moment when I first saw it, that's when the realization for me was that I am a trans woman. And I always stick to I stick to the terms of trans woman, because I know that I'll never be a cisgender female. I know that I have a prostate and that'll never change. And I also don't want to offend anybody, because in my culture, in my demographic, it's offensive to a lot of females. So I don't know if I use that reason for it. I know, I'm sure I do, but I think I also use the fact that I know that my ultimate goal is to be the best trans woman, because that's as far as it gets for me, and that's as far as I want to go. But I think that once I saw it for myself, whether anybody else saw it for me, because women have all shapes, sizes, facial features, and everything else. Some women could look exactly like a man. So for me, I think that, but that doesn't change the fact that they're women, cisgender women. So I don't think that you have to have a certain look or a certain body type or whatever to see it for yourself or for people or to identify as such. So I think that once I realized and I saw this, what was down the road for me, that's when I felt that I was able to say that confidently.
No, I think one of the themes that I'm hearing is how much each of us, you know, weighed this journey, this question of who am I and what does that mean for my life? You know, it feels like there's sometimes this idea that people have that you just wake up and decide you're trans and poof, all these things happen. And of course, that's not the case, as we've heard here, that folks take on different journeys first to understand who they are and then to change if that is a decision, if changing is a decision that folks do in fact make. And so I love hearing the stories of the different ways that we've all thought about this, and it really underlines the need for us to recognize self-determination. We are who we say we are, because we know ourselves best, and none of us comes to this idea that we're trans, you know, just by happenstance. And that kind of leads into this next question that I get a lot from folks. And I really do think it comes from a good place, though sometimes it can feel a little bit like an ouch. But the question is like, hey, what's going on here? It seems like there are a lot more trans people than there used to be.
My mom was left-handed when she was growing up, and she went to a Catholic school. And there were no left-handed kids in Catholic schools because they beat them and made them stop being left-handed. That doesn't mean those kids weren't left-handed. It just means that they weren't visibly left-handed. They hid it to make sure that they stayed safe. And I think that was a large part of what you're seeing now, was that the safety of being trans had created the appearance of being safer. There were more trans people. The information was more accessible. So you have more people better able to understand who they are, because they now have the vernacular, the tools, the understanding to find that. And I think the other part is that we as a culture have put a heavy magnifying glass on the community. The community really, it might be big, but it's not that big. And I think that when you're seeing it on the news 20 times a day, when you scroll on Facebook and that's half the posts you see are posts that are being magnified to show more trans issues because they're controversial. It creates the appearance of a lot of trans people, even when it's just not that big. Like, it's a big population, numerically speaking, but percentage-wise, it's still very small.
You are right about that. I think the last time I checked, which was not very long ago, 1.6% of the population of the United States identifies as trans. So still a really small community. Ebony, what do you think here?
I 100% agree with Gwen. I think that they've blown that up to make it seem like it's so many more than what it really is. For me, I think that there is maybe 3 degrees of separation between trans people. I feel like if I don't know that person, I know someone that knows that person or someone else. So I don't think that there are that many people. I think that because there are so many issues and so many topics geared around trans people, it makes it seem like there are a lot more of us than it really are.
I definitely agree about the visibility piece and the knowledge and vernacular piece that Gwen mentioned, for sure. You know, if you don't know that something is possible, like, I didn't have the terms or the language or the examples when I was a child to know that what I am, like, how to express that and that it was okay. You know, so I think people being able to see themselves in media, see themselves out in public spaces, not always being victimized or stereotyped or in a negative connotation, that gives them that safety feeling for sure.
Now, all of us on this panel are adults, but I'm hoping we may have some insight for this questioner who asks about children who are 10 and below. And the question is, how do young children age 10 or below know that they don't feel like their biological sex assigned at birth? How or why would a child even begin to worry about something like that?
So I'm happy to talk about it from my own personal perspective, just because I am someone that I didn't have the language for it, but, you know, I knew I was like maybe 5 or 6 when I knew that I was not comfortable necessarily being called or identified as a girl. So I think that kind of hits to the demographic that they're looking at. There are certain things in life that you understand to be really affirming, and you only know that when you experience that. And it's something that we get really good at as an adult to say, oh, this makes me feel good because of X, Y, and Z. As children, they don't necessarily know why something feels good to them, but they do have the ability to know something feels good, right? They know when they like a certain food or they don't like a specific texture. This is something that's really innate. And I think adults have a really bad habit of, one, gaslighting children into saying that they're not old enough for X, Y, and Z, right? You're not old enough to know what this is, or you're not old enough to have these kind of feelings, or you're not old enough to even understand, you know, what this is. So we really do a disservice at assuming that they don't have the ability to feel for themselves already whether or not they start to identify a certain way. It's not that they're worrying, am I a boy or am I a girl? It's more that I know that this feels right. So when I was young, before my parents really kind of put the negativity on it, and it was something that I started to feel a lot of shame around feeling, I had no shame on it. I didn't classify it as a worry. I just knew that I liked when people called me a guy. All of my friends were guys. I fit in with them, and I thought of us as exactly the same. And it wasn't until that outward shame got put on it that I understood there's something wrong with this for some people, right? I wasn't coming at it as a, oh my God, I'm worrying about being called a girl. The worry wasn't there. It was more about the good feelings, the affirming feelings. And then, you know, children who are 10 are already kind of hitting puberty. And for me, that point in life was viscerally uncomfortable. I did everything that I could to fight back against puberty until it was really inevitable in certain ways. And that, when that discomfort starts to become really kind of consuming for an individual, that's when it becomes more apparent that they really need to identify where that's stemming from. And for me, that was, you know, a incongruency with my sex assigned at birth versus my gender identity.
Gwen, do you want to weigh in on this one?
I mean, we do know that developmentally that children get an idea of how gender works at the age of like 5 or so. Like, that is something that has been studied psychologically. We know that that is true. But I have, I'm going to speak vaguely about a couple of my friends. I have a friend whose daughter, who is trans, asked her when she was, I don't know, girl was probably like 3 or 4, but asked her if her penis was going to fall off when she hit puberty, because girls don't have those. And she knew that. And she just wanted to know if hers was just going to fall off, because she knew it didn't belong on her body, but she didn't know why she had it. I know a person who is in their 60s or 70s now, who ended up not transitioning because of family pressure and things, who was vocalizing that they weren't a girl at the age of 3, continued to vocalize that on a fairly regular basis, caused a lot of fights in their family about it, ended up just having to kind of bail out because they couldn't deal with it anymore. She still did not choose to transition, and is now just kind of, you know, living life, but made that call. I, like, when I was a kid, I didn't understand why my cousin, who was about my age and who looked a little bit like me before puberty, like, why she was so pretty and I was so ugly. Like, why was I this way and she was that way? I didn't get it. And that got worse at puberty, but I also still didn't really understand why it was the way it was. I just knew that she was kind of getting the life that I wanted, but I didn't really understand what I was thinking or feeling in those moments, because no one had ever taught me the language or the skills to understand those things. So I think that it's not hard to see that kids do understand gender. It's, I think a lot of the confusion that we have around it is this idea that parents are pushing their kids to be trans. Like, I'm a parent and I am terrified that my kids are going to be trans, because I don't want them to have to go through the stress of transitioning and how difficult it is. But obviously I would support them 100%, but it was still something I've been worried about. Like, no one's pressuring their kids to transition, and no one's like doing surgeries on a 10-year-old or hormone therapy on a 10-year-old. That's just not a realistic thing. And we have this perspective that it is because of the phrasing that has been being used by people in power.
You hit on so many good points there, Gwen. And I think one of them is that there's such a misunderstanding about what any sort of transition looks like when you're 10 or, you know, 6. And it often looks like, I cut my hair, or I changed what I was wearing, or I asked people to use a different name. And there's so much misinformation out there about, you know, when kids access medical parts of their transition. And I think the other part that Gwen, both you and Sterling hit on, is this idea that if a young person affirms their gender identity, that is to say, if they're cisgender, we never question if they're too young to know that, right? So if their gender identity, that internal sense of who you are, male, female, or something else, that's who we are on the inside. It's not determined by what's put on our birth certificate, right? So one of these things that I think a lot of people forget is all of us have a gender identity. For most of us, our gender identity matches our sex or what we could think of as our anatomy. But for a small percentage of us, our gender identity, who we know ourselves to be, doesn't match our sex. And the way this plays out with kids, it's I'm a parent, Gwyneth. I heard you say you're a parent too. When I'm talking to other parents, I often hear them say things like, oh, he's such a boy, or oh, she's a girly girl. But they only say these things when a child's gender expression matches their anatomy. When we see a child express their gender in ways that don't match their sex or their anatomy, we think, oh, whoa, that's too young. You're too young. So that is to say, like, a child is never too young to know their cisgender, but until they're 18, they can't possibly know their transgender. I mean, to me, that doesn't make any sense. So that's kind of what I heard you saying, and hopefully that resonates a little bit. I've got two questions left here, and they both bring a smile to my face. One is a really lovely question from someone. They say, since we are living in a state that isn't accepting of the trans community, what can we do as allies to support transgender people in South Carolina? What can we do to show our support and love? Ebony, what do you think? How can allies support trans folks in South Carolina?
I think for me, the best way an ally can support a transgender person is to understand what trans is. You know, sometimes we have people who say that I'm an ally and they love me to death, but the next trans person, he's the F word or whatever. But so how can you support me and see me one way and see this person the other way? I think that as an ally, you need to understand what trans is as a whole, not just your trans friend or the trans person that's around you. Understand trans as a whole. That way you can support us equally and not just picking and choosing on who you support.
Gwen, what do you think?
I mean, I do think it's really important, like Ebony said, to understand the trans community as a whole. But right now, the reality is we need political pressure. We need financial pressure. It's super easy to say you're an ally, but like, man, we really need people who are willing to write in to their senators and their congressmen and to put political pressure on these people to do what's actually right, and to get them to see that if they continue to bow to big donors, that it's actually going to hurt them in the long run. Also, like, the reality is the community does often end up needing support for things like accessing their appointments and making sure that, like, in some cases, helping them move. Like, the reality is there's a lot of people who have fled this area. I know multiple families who have left the state because they can't access their health care anymore. And it's a big expense and it is very difficult to do unless you're in a very good financial position. Moving is expensive. I think people really need to start realizing they're going to have to do more than stick a flag up at a protest or whatever, that there's going to be more to it. And I think that it's going to be harder and people need to be more willing to take action to protect the community.
Preach, Gwen. You're speaking my language. Sterling, what do you think?
I definitely agree with what has already been said by the other two. The other thing that I would like to add to it is know who you're voting for and go and vote. I live in an area that is represented by Nancy Mace, who is hugely vocal anti-trans, both in the actual, Congress chambers and at home. So just know who you're voting for. Make sure that they're people that support us. And if you're in a space where you hear people talking either in an uneducated way or against trans individuals, then speak up as well, right? Don't just let it go. you need to be the voice. If no one else there is going to be the voice for you, but the voting is really one of the biggest ways that I want to add to what's already been said.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like you all hit all the facets. It's like support individuals, take care of people, not just the people you know, but the community. That's what I heard from Ebony, from Gwen, like get involved in advocacy. You know, don't just go to protests, but talk to your elected officials and tell them what your values are and that you want them to, you know, cast votes that support trans people. And then what Sterling is saying is, hey, let's make sure we're voting for folks who don't attack trans people, but who act to support the dignity and safety and well-being of trans people. I love everything. Thank you for that. Our last question is about joy, because in the debate about transgender people, and especially about transgender kids, there's this whole narrative about regret, this idea that trans people regret their transitions. And, you know, the data tells us that regret is astonishingly low. You know, the rate of regret for gender-affirming healthcare, it's less than 2%. And I mean, hell, 6% of people regret getting a knee replacement, right? So like, regret is just not a very big thing in the trans community, and yet that seems to be of a lot of concern to some elected officials. But back to the question, which is not about regret. It is about joy. Where do you find gender joy?
Where do I find gender joy? This is going to be the most underwhelming answer you're probably going to get. Being able to be myself every day in a way that I finally feel comfortable being. That honestly has made me a much happier person. You know, I've had many different people in my life, friends and family, tell me constantly that I'm so much happier. I'm a much better person to be around. I'm not angry all the time. And it sounds silly because a lot of people take for granted being able to just walk out their front door and be who they want to be seen for who they are, be accepted for who they are, and not have people question or ask or be intrusive or attack. So just being able to go out into the world, go grocery shopping, go to the bar with my friends, go to a bookstore, and just be myself unequivocally. That is what brings me the most joy.
I don't think that's underwhelming at all, Sterling. I think all of us humans have this deep desire to be seen. And I think that's what you're talking about, being seen as who you are. Ebony, what brings you gender joy?
That's a very, very easy question for me. And I hate to keep going back to my age, but every question seems to bring me there. The thing that brings me the most gender joy is being on this panel with, I'm pretty sure the majority of you guys are 20 or 30 years younger than I am. And you guys are living your lives authentically. And it makes me extremely joyful to see that happen at your age, because I know what happened at mine. And to see people now in this day and in this time, people who are much younger, being able to identify and understand who they are and why they're that way, that brings me the most joy. Because I never, when I was your age, I never thought that I would live to see this happen. So that brings me joy more than anything special happening within my own personal life, to actually see this act out in real time.
Ebony, thank you for that. I mean, I feel like we are standing on your shoulders and on the shoulders of those who 20 and 30 years ago, you know, paved the path forward. And when we're living in this time right now when the government is turning its back on trans people. And I often tell folks, the government can't erase us. We know who we are. And there were times 20 and 30 years ago, not even that long ago, when the government had also turned its back on trans people. And Ebony, you're a testimony to what can be accomplished for those who fight like hell to live authentically, even in the darkest of days. Gwen, I'm going to let you round us out here. What brings you gender joy?
I mean, I think Sterling did a great job talking about like just the feeling of getting to be myself every day without having to constantly wear the mask of being a man is everything to me. I had mentioned that like my wife and I had a bit of a hard time after when I first started my transition process. And at this point, she'll often tell people that I am so much more of myself. I'm just happier. I'm at more peace with who I am. I love loving people in a way that I never was able to before. I'm all of the best things of me that were all kind of like scrolled and hidden away that are now just right on the surface for everyone to see. And I love getting to be that version of myself now.
I love hearing these stories of joy. Thank you for sharing them. I think it's so important that we recognize that while there are unprecedented and harmful attacks on transgender people right now, being trans is full of beauty and joy and creativity and love and so much more. And you three are such a testament to that. Thank you for being here, for sharing so much of who you are with folks who are listening. I really can't thank you enough. Thank you for listening to another episode of While I Breathe. Paul, thanks for being a fly on the wall for that conversation. Incredible people. You know, what was that experience like for you?
Yeah, it was an honor. I was just sitting in the background being the sound engineer, but you know, this reminds me of conversations I've had with trans people in my life that I always come away thinking about what it means to live authentically and how sometimes that is a monumental effort. And sometimes that takes a loving community that supports you. And I learned a few things today. And I think I was really moved by something Ebony said toward the end there. She said, I never thought I would see this happen. And like, I don't think she was just talking about the podcast episode, but she was talking about, you know, meeting younger trans people living out in the world authentically. It was a really beautiful thing. And I have a lot more reasons to show up and fight in 2025.
Yeah, man, right on. I'm so grateful to Ebony and Gwen and Sterling and to the folks who are brave enough to send in their questions. It can be hard to be vulnerable, to ask questions, and it's extremely hard to share your story and to be vulnerable in that way. So appreciate the bravery across the board.
Well, again, for those interested in showing up for trans rights or for any other rights of you and your fellow South Carolinians, there will be opportunities to, you know, go through training as an advocate, opportunities to show up and speak at the State House, all kinds of opportunities to join the work. So again, the link for that is aclusc.org/volunteer. And there's a volunteer form there. You fill it out. You let us know what part of the state you're from, what kind of work you're interested in, and we'll put you to work. We'll find places for you to get involved. Again, that's aclusc.org/volunteer.
And until next time, while I breathe, I hope.
You think that made sense?
I think so. I think it's going to be a good episode.